Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 308 of the Eat PhD Team podcast with myself and Anna. Hi Anna, how are you?
I am good, thank you. I'm feeling very spring-like today. How are you?
Same actually. It was a bad day to wear grey.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lift my arms up on this podcast. I'll just keep them down because that is not a bad.
Well, I mean, I'm not quite the t-shirt there. I'm still, this is like light knitwear, maybe one day, but I'm out of the sheet fleece, so hey.
The times have changed. I mean, I did have a jacket on when I was outside, but I'm just think, you know, when you get a wee pace on. I mean, I sweat quite easily at the moment, to be quite honest. But yeah, and also because since I got pregnant, I've been wearing natural deodorant, quote unquote natural deodorant, and it doesn't stop you sweating, in my opinion. The one that I use definitely does not stop me sweating. And my friend recommended it, she's like, it's so good. And I was like, why do you not smell every day? I mean, I guess you don't smell till the next day, so it's fine if you shower every day. But honestly, it's not the one. Like if I'm doing an event or something, I don't wear my natural deodorant.
maybe like the recommendation came because they're just not a very sweaty person. I don't know.
And you are right that I am. So
well, no, that wasn't a dig at you, but I do think people that aren't like don't have that in mind. They're like, yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm like, it's not because have you seen them?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can feel the damp under my arms, so it's not. as soon as I don't want to wear natural, I'll be straight back to the extra strength, whatever that one may be. I'll be finding it. Okay, we had ranted on. I actually had an opinion which apparently, according to a man, is something that was unexpected of me on my social media yesterday about Zoe diet, because it's now been branded as the anti-diet diet just because it's inclusive. It's inclusive of apparently all foods, but obviously I assume not ultra processed foods because, you know, they've spent 12 months demonizing those. And I've obviously ranted a little bit on my emails about Zoe diet and stuff like that before, and I've gone into like the evidence behind it. Yesterday's post when I ranted, it wasn't even evidence-based. It was literally just, it wasn't not evidence-based. It was unconditional permission to eat and fiber, both evidence-based. But it was so, like the Daily Mail, I don't know if it's the Daily Mail's fault or Zoe Diet's fault or whoever's fault it was, but they just were like, oh, move over Ozempic. This is all you need to lose weight. And it's an anti-diet diet. None of that makes sense. None of that makes sense. How can you have an... The goal is fat loss. It's not anti-diet. End of discussion. And it's so toxic to take like all of the strengths of the anti-diet space, of which there are many, and then make it and taint it with diet. We use a lot of the anti-diet stuff within our, if we've got clients who want fat loss, we use a lot of the anti-diet messaging, but we'll never call it anti-diet because we're pro-diet for people who want to diet, right? It's so bad. Honestly, if anyone is still thinking, oh, maybe I should try the Zoe diet, like there's no evidence. Like Dr. Nicola Guest did a really good post the other day about the new research study that they funded that they say backs up the Zoe diet and how unbelievably flawed it is and how badly designed it is. But of course they funded it, they designed it, they got it published, and so now they can say it's evidence-based. But this study is just, it basically compares the Zoe diet to like, they had two groups, like the Zoe diet and then people who got like a leaflet effectively on like, this is what nutrition is. And then said the Zoe diet is like superior to other diets or whatever it was. I don't know what their outcome was, I can't remember. It's just ludicrous. It's ludicrous. And it's just getting to the point where it's just like, I never want to talk about it anymore because I'm so bored of talking about it. But honestly, are they just selling it to Daily Mail? Does Daily Mail have, does Daily Mail have shares in it? I don't know, but it pissed me off. It was like, oh, with measure, what did it say? It said something like, look at your poo samples. With by looking at poo samples, we know that having fibers helps satiety. Oh, shocking. Shocking. Anyway, I've read about this on the EIQ podcast the other day too. So if you listen to that one and you listen to this one, I'm really sorry. I'm done now.
Do you know what? I treated myself. I popped into M&S earlier to pick up some nice salad
Oh, I love M&S.
because I was like, well, it's definitely time for salad, and was in the like the lunch section, and they had the I love the little like if I'm ever in a supermarket, which is rare these days because I am lazy and do click and collect instead, but I get the like little kefir shots. And in M&S, it was M&S like with Zoe. And I was like, on principle, I'm not picking that up.
Oh,
But
no.
my gut health can suffer because I'm not doing that.
Oh yeah, I'm good. Like that is frustrating because it's like if that's a product you want or you'd like to try it or whatever, you're like, yeah, but then no, we ju you just don't want to put the money into their pockets.
No. So I'll have
Oh, that's
to
a shame.
do something else for gut health.
I hear really good things about M&S's new dips. You tried them? Have you tried them all?
It's I've not tried them all, but I've done like girl dinner and picky tea.
Yes. I want to try the super green one. Although it kind of just looks like avocado, but I don't know if I just saw it on TikTok or
Don't think
something.
I've seen that one. The one in Loughborough is, I mean,
You
for
too.
Loughborough it's great, but it's still limited.
There, I will feedback. I've been on to, because we've had decorators in all week in the kitchen, I haven't been able to cook, so I've been on to like those ball
Oh,
meals.
they're fantastic.
They're so good. On top of a salad bowl with scoop up with poppadoms. Top notch. Okay. Do you, Anna, do you want to get started on the questions?
Yes, I have done a lot of work on my relationship with exercise, but I still get a bit jealous when my sisters and friends are out running half marathons, doing CrossFit competitions, and just doing all the things I used to and would love to get back to. I don't feel like I should push myself to that yet in terms of hormones, as I want to get back to it slowly but surely, so not to lose my period again. But how do I know if I'm being overcautious and can push myself in training for these types of things, or whether I should give it more time? So this client has restored her cycle and it's been regular now for a good few months.
I think one thing is it's okay to be a bit jealous of those things. Like over time that will change and keep coming back to the fact that you're doing something that's really important to you and it's you're prioritizing your health and that's actually a really hard and courageous thing to do. So like when you do notice those pangs, like come back to the fact that you're doing something really positive for yourself. You're never really gonna know until you do it, ultimately. But tapering it in is the way, like I'm sure you'll do this with Anna, but trusting that by tapering it in, if you notice any irregularities through tracking your cycle, like if your luteal phase changes or your menstrual cycle days get longer, or you see any changes, then you know, okay, well, I can just pull it back again because I've just tapered it in. You're not immediately going from moderate to super high intensity, because that will be an additional stressor on your body, but slowly incorporating new things in will give you time if something is not quite quote unquote right to change it again. But also trust that you're probably going to do things differently this time. You're going to make sure you're well fueled. You're going to make sure you're managing your calorie intake across the entire day, not just like trying to eat as little as possible, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're recovering well and feeling well and managing your stress, try to not to be too fearful of it because you're doing everything as best you can.
Yeah, nothing to add.
Okay, Georgia.
Will I notice any benefits of adding kimchi to my diet?
Probably not.
I was gonna say, like,
Witches.
I don't know about you guys. I probably have it maybe 2-3 times a week. I enjoy the taste, but I don't think I notice the benefit of it. It's just knowing that it's doing good for my gut health and it adds enjoyment to a meal.
2 to 3 times a week. Good for you.
Do you know what it is? My mum's obviously obsessed with this sort of thing. Like she has her kefir grains that she makes every morning, and that's great. And she bought me a like taster pack, so I've got 3 or 4 different flavors of kimchi, and it's great. It's just a nice little thing to add on.
Nice. Do you have a charger?
Yeah, I've got a big tub from Costco, and it's really good. It's like from Korea, so it's like proper delicious kimchi. But I probably don't eat it 3 times a week. I'm like a once or twice a week. But I like other fermented foods, so I feel like I get a good mix throughout the week. If I eat the same thing too often, I kind of get really bored. So I like to kind of keep the novelty of it.
My mum discovered through her yoga this company called, I think they're called like Edinburgh Fermentarium or something, and they do a lot of fermented foods and sauerkrauts and different types, and that they are very good, very good. So if you're, I don't know if they just do local, but if you're Edinburgh based or around there, I highly recommend. Yeah, you're not probably going to notice, like in terms of fermented foods, they potentially might be helpful for our gut microbiome, but in terms of the evidence, it's not really there yet. And I say yet because it might get there. There's mechanistic reasoning why it could be potentially helpful, but it's not there yet. So it's a great healthful thing potentially to add to your diet. It's delicious. It adds variety and new plant into your diet probably. But the thing with your gut is that you're never going to know really if one thing specifically has done something to your gut, like, or to your gut microbiome. It's not like you eat one food and then that's all you do all day and you can see if you're bloating or whatever, because your gut, your digestion is dependent on so many different factors that we've spoken about before in terms of like stress, different types of foods that you eat, when you eat, what you ate yesterday, if you've moved your body, hydration levels, self-regulation. There's so many things that can impact it. So you're never going to know, which is, I think, is always why it's important when you think, oh, I'm bloating a lot, it must be because I'm eating more of X. We automatically go to food because, like, yes, if something's changed, it's helpful to look at that, if the thing that's changed, but it's not as simple as just being like, oh, well, I'll just take that food out. It's probably just that. Okay. But how do I challenge my own weight bias with myself and others? For example, being fat is lazy. I guess I'll just jump in.
Oh, yeah, you
I
go.
was just typing. I keep notes of what we're talking about on the podcast, obviously, for the podcast edit. So I was just typing, and usually by the time I finish typing,
I was having a long, hard think, apparently.
I was starting to get a little bit like, oh, is it frozen? I think the first step is obviously awareness, and you're aware of it, and that's actually really incredible. So that's the first thing. And then I think you have to begin to just call yourself on it. So if you notice yourself making judgments of people, then call it and name it for what it is. Like, oh, that's weight bias or weight stigma. And just not in a judgmental way, just in a curious way of going, okay, I wonder where else this shows up in my life. You don't have to do anything specific, but just notice where it pops up. Name it, allow it, and move on. Because the main thing is that you want to change it, you want to challenge it, right? So that's fantastic. I think the other thing is like learning a lot more about it. I've done a couple of podcasts on it, and there's lo so many blogs about it, so many books about it. A lot, like, is fat a feminist issue? That's a good book. Like, challenge yourself to learn more, and those types of books and blogs, etc., will highlight to you maybe where it might come up for you, and then you might not have even thought that was weight bias at the time, but you can just keep learning. And again, don't judge yourself for it, that you have it, you experience it as a result of the society that we live in, and it's not right, but you don't choose to think that way. So great that you're aware, and great that you can change it.
I'm reading a really good book at the moment. I've only just started, called Fat Talk. And it's about like weight stigma and sorry, fat stigma and weight bias. And it's a challenging read so far for me. There's a few times I've been like, oh, okay, like that's actually called me out on a few things. So I will update you as I read a bit more of it, because I've not got a huge amount to say at the moment, but really, really good book, and written like really accessibly as well. And it's also written by a woman in a larger body. So definitely a great place to start, I would say. And she gives some like resources and references and things as she goes as well. So that might be a nice read.
Nice. Excellent. What did you say it was called?
Fat Talk.
Okay, fab. Thanks. Anna.
So following Lynn's pelvic floor session at the weekend, I've seen pelvic floor trainers advertised online before, and I'm wondering if these actually work, or am I better off squeezing to the beat of Taylor Swift?
Always Taylor Swift, is that correct? I have heard of these pelvic floor trainers. I think that largely they are marketing. I don't I've heard about the breast pump that I want to buy. I know they have a pelvic floor thing, and I looked at it. But I think they're quite expensive often, and I don't think that they're definitely not mandatory. I think there's so much that you can do around your pelvic floor that doesn't require spending money, that I wouldn't spend your money.
Googled.
I'm like, well, I was wondering what you were doing. I don't, I, unless I would say unless you go to like a pelvic floor specialist, who recommends something specific like that, I wouldn't invest in something like that. I would focus, again, not just on like Kegels. It's not just Kegels, it's your entire core, like your transverse abdominis. Like, you really want to think about it. Do it in the gym, and do it with your movement, and start to practice just doing daily breath work, pelvic floor contraction, relaxation. That should be the word. Just saying, pelvic floor relaxation. As you inhale, abdominal relaxation as you inhale, alongside some like diaphragmatic breathing, and then contraction. I heard a really great cue for breathing the other day on the course that I'm doing, the perinatal pre and postnatal course I'm doing. So they said one at the ETPHD event, which is like breathe through your holes. So when you're inhaling, breathe through your holes, which is very effective, and that's like relaxation. But then the contraction side of things, the course I'm doing, by the way, is person who runs it's called Brianna Battles. She's great. So credit to her for this. But she said, on the contraction, the cue is zip your clit. And she was like, lots of people just go kind of Kegel and squeeze everything. But if you think about, like, we'll just think about the visual of zipping your clit and contracting that way whilst contracting your core, it's a really great way to do it. So I would focus on that, and timing it with your movements. So, for example, if you're doing an RDL, breathing in through your holes, diaphragmatic, like inhale, relax on the way down, contract, zip your clit on the way up. I would think spend your time there and save your money than spending it on those things.
Yeah, I haven't seen any of those contraptions, but at the menopause cafe that I've been going to, the one last month was run by a pelvic health physiotherapist. She was incredible. And she took us through loads of different exercises and kind of explained, quite in depth with her little pictures of like vaginas and everything kind of like internally. And yeah, not once did she recommend any kind of contraption or spending any kind of money. It was all kind of like training those muscles, just sort of with squeezing and relaxing. So yeah, I would go with the professional on that one.
So one thing that I have been looking at is there's a couple of products. One's called like, these are brands, by the way, I'm not endorsing them, but I haven't bought one. One's called Epino and one's called Anabol. And they're like preparation for birth contraptions. And they are basically like, the best way I can describe this is like, they're like a balloon with a pump on them. And you insert it into your vagina, you pump it up, and then you practice like your pelvic floor breathing. And you learn, like, you learn, you know, as you relax your pelvic floor, the balloon will like move down, i.e., it's kind of like a push. And as you contract your pelvic floor, it will move up. And the idea, I think it's twofold of like, one, you begin to feel more in control and aware and understand like what's going to happen to your body through labor and how your breath impacts that. And two, I think there's an element of like training your vagina to expand or get used to that. Now, I'm not sure about this. I'm not, one, I don't know if these products have any evidence behind them whatsoever. Or that they work. I've just seen them advertised. I think they're an interesting product. And one of the companies messaged me about having a call, and I was like, "What do you want to have a call about? Because I don't know if I can. I don't know if I'm going to endorse your product." But it's interesting. There's so many products for people who menstruate, and it's like, what's legit and what's just a marketing scam. On the whole, things like female health products like washes and stuff, I used to buy into all of that stuff, and now I'm like, oh, it was all just bloody capitalism and crap. But you live and learn.
But they don't, because you still get scented sanitary towels, and it's like, why is this perfumed? Every month I have a rant about this, trying to find something that's not scented.
Yeah,
drives me insane.
I forgot about those.
No.
I like them when I was younger. And as a kid, and I was all about patriarchy. I say kid, old enough to menstruate, obviously. Okay, Georgia.
One of Becca's clients has asked, has the team read Tim Spector's new book? I'm intrigued to hear your thoughts. I found myself thinking lately when looking at my podcast feed and social media that if only we thought this hard about other areas of our life or society, the things we could achieve instead of obsessing over food.
Preach. And weirdly, we were talking about this at the start of the podcast. Well, we weren't talking about him, we were talking about Zoe. I mean, I've not read the book, have you? Anyone?
No, I've seen the title, but it's gone from my head. It's something like How to Eat or The Science of Eating.
I think you're right. No, I wouldn't waste my time based on a lot of the things that I said at the beginning of this podcast. Keep in mind, he's not a nutritionist. Putting that out there. He's a medical doctor, and I mean, I have nothing to say about him as a person. I just have said everything I feel like I want to say about the Zoe diet. There isn't evidence to back up what they do right now. Poo samples are not necessarily reflective of our gut microbiome. There's just, they promote blood glucose monitoring, which we know is not evidence-based at all for people who are healthy. And what pisses me off, and what I imagine is in books like this, is the demonising of ultra-processed foods that, yes, we know eating your entire diet of ultra-processed foods is not helpful. Including some ultra-processed foods in your diet sometimes is fine. And I'm so, it's it feels very, this sort of stuff feels very American to me. Like in the States, they love This is not the people of the States. I just mean the nutrition guidance in the States. They love to like demonize foods, and they're still very quote unquote clean eating. And I follow some fantastic American practitioners, but I also follow just people that I know or whatever who also do nutrition, and they just utter shit that they put out because they're still in that world of clean eating and ultra processed foods and seed oils, and it all feels very that it's not evidence based. But you're totally right. I think obviously one of the tools that we use at EDPHD is looking at how much time you spend on food in your body and where you'd like to spend your time, and setting goals in line with other things can be really helpful, as opposed to just going, I wish I didn't spend so much time on food, which is not you, the person who's asked this question.
Yeah, he's a professor of genetics, isn't he? His first book was about ultra processed food. I don't think you need to write a book about ultra processed food. I think we all know it's not the same as eating apples, like, but whatever. Just in case.
Agree. Oh, it's me. It's me. Navigating needing, in brackets, and choosing to go on a restrictive diet like FODMAP for medical reasons while still working on relationship with food.
I feel like that one is thinking, like really connecting to like why you're doing it and not seeing it as a restriction. And the reason I say that is because like I worked with a dietitian about 15 years ago or so to do an elimination diet to see, what was kind of happening with migraines, if there was any link between food and migraines. And we kind of, to do that, it means that you remove anything that's a potential trigger so that you kind of have like a complete washout. And then you reintroduce different triggers like in isolation at different times. So it meant for, quite a period of time, like 6 months, I couldn't have anything with like sulfites in it. So I couldn't have like dried fruit or fruit and nut bars. And we removed every kind of dairy, so there was no type of cheese, no whey. That was a time when I was like, eating a lot of protein that mostly came from dairy. And it for me that didn't feel restrictive because I wasn't doing it to be restrictive. I was doing it to find out what, if anything, needed to be removed short term or long term, and therefore what else I could include out of this list of potential triggers. So it's kind of the same with FODMAPs, is that you're not removing all those things forever. It's a short period of time. And then the idea is that you're actually intentionally reintroducing them. And if you notice that something is an issue for you, then you can make that choice to say, okay, well, I know what happens when I eat this food, and I can choose to say, I'm not going to eat that because the consequences aren't good enough. Or like my sister, on occasion, you can say, yeah, this really messes me up, but I love tiramisu. So on a Friday night, she might treat herself to a tiramisu and then just spend Saturday in bed as a choice. So it's about freedom, isn't it? Rather than about restriction. And I think if you take that mindset, it can really help you to navigate that difference between what feels like restriction and what's actually a boundary with that food.
Love that. I love that framing. And I agree, like, again, this is not the same, but in pregnancies, it's probably the first time that I've had to have dietary restrictions, or it's felt like it's been imposed on me. When I've had restrictions in the past, I've imposed them on myself. But the point, similar to what you're saying, Georgia, like I'm still choosing not to have brie or like tons of tuna fish, which weirdly I don't eat. But when I fell pregnant, I was like, I'd love a bit of tuna fish and a jacket potato. And licorice, I'm like, oh, all I want is licorice, all sorts. At the moment, and I'm like, no, but I'm choosing to have one at night if I want one, as opposed to in the past I would have eaten like half a bag or whatever. And but it's a choice, and it's like, okay, I yes, it's restriction, but okay, I can have it. And what we did in Malta, when I had halloumi and a tiny little bit of feta, and then I was like, oh my God, I don't even know if that was pasteurized. The women didn't really know. And I didn't care before because I was hungry. And then I ate it. And then I was like, oh my God, should have eaten it. Oh my God, I'm going to give myself listeria, Googling away. And then Anna's Googling away, and it's fine. But like I made the choice in that moment of like, I'm going to choose to allow myself this and live with the consequences. And those consequences, I was so anxious afterwards that I will not make that choice again. In the UK, like Hulu means when I can see the labels, I know like those things are fine. It's just that at that point, and being in a different country, I couldn't read the labels. So it wasn't worth the outcome. But it is, it's like you get to choose to do this for your health or for your baby or for whatever reason it is that you're restricting. And that is a transient thing, like you said. Anna, I think.
What was it? How do you improve body acceptance, not neutrality? Is this realistic for everybody to have as a goal?
So body acceptance kind of comes alongside body neutrality, right? So acceptance is like acceptance of your body for what it is or what she is or how she shows up, and regardless of any, like, it's about not having like judgments or not having judgments on your body and just accept, like if you were thinking about accepting a person, you accept them as they are. Body neutrality is reaching a place of appreciating your body for what it can do, and what it allows, right? Both of which are not dependent on thinking about the way that you look. So the question was, how do you get to body acceptance?
How do you improve body acceptance, not neutrality? And is this realistic for everyone?
Okay, so one way to improve body acceptance is by working on body neutrality. They are separate in what they are, if you're looking at like a textbook definition, but you can't, all of this stuff is like little threads and they're all tied in together, and you can't really pick one thread out at a time. Like if you were reading a book and like, okay, I'm going to work on this one specific thing and ignore the rest and nothing else is going to change. And that's actually a great thing. One of the reasons that body image work is a core pillar of ETPHD method is because we started off with food. It started with food. And then we're like, oh, actually, in order to support disordered eating, we need to support body image because they're so intricately linked. And not everyone struggles with all of the things and all of the pillars, but they're all intricately linked in some way, shape or form. So you, body neutrality would be helpful to get to a place of body acceptance. And I think for me, thinking about trying or not focusing on the way that your body looks genuinely is going to be one of the best things that you can do to support body acceptance. I think acceptance is a place that everyone can get to. Do I think that body positivity is a place everyone can get to? No. And do I think that like loving your body all the time is where everyone can get to? No. But I do think even if you struggle with the way that your body looks, maybe you struggle with the way that your body functions, maybe you have like chronic pain, and maybe you're going through recurrent miscarriage and also you don't like the way that your body looks. Do I think acceptance in that place is possible to get to? Yes, but I think it's certainly harder if you feel like your body is quote unquote letting you down in some way, which is definitely not in these cases, but from working with a lot of people in these situations, it can definitely feel that way, right? But you can get to the place where it's like, I accept that my body has a harder time with X. I accept that this is how my body shows up in the world whilst she's experiencing, you know, fibro, like it's fibro month, right? So I accept that's how my body shows up with fibro. It doesn't mean that you're not like, oh my God, this is annoying sometimes. It doesn't mean that you're not frustrated sometimes. But I do believe everyone can get to the point of just saying, okay, it's kind of like it is what it is. Radical acceptance of anything in life, whether it's your body or something else, is kind of like, okay, what can I control and what can I not control? And yeah, it is what it is. And I don't mean that in a belittling way. Georgia.
I don't know whether any of you have seen The Game Changers on Netflix, but any views on the message conveyed by medical professionals that any animal protein, including dairy, is causing inflammation is bad for you and you're way better off without it. That was Lynn's client. I've not seen Game Changers.
Neither have I.
Which one was it?
It was one of
Not that I
the
watch all of them by any stretch of the imagination, but it rings a bell.
I
I
think it
can't.
was one of the older ones, wasn't it? I think.
Yeah, I think it was the one where it was very everybody should go vegan because that's the best.
Has anyone watched the new one? That healthier hack? Hack your health.
Oh, it's on my to-watch list purely out of I know clients will ask about it, so I'm like, okay, I'm gonna try and get there before you guys finish it.
Right, you take one for the team, Georgia, and
Okay.
feedback.
Oh, I should have kept quiet.
Yeah, this was like vegan propaganda, you're right. There's no evidence at all that, like, for example, dairy is leading to systemic and chronic inflammation. The problem with all of this type of messaging is that they go, oh, it's causing an inflammatory response when you eat it. Ask someone what that means. Like, what does that mechanistically mean? And show me the evidence of what that means on a full body level over time. You cannot do that because exercise is inflammatory. That's what DOMS is. It's an inflammatory response to exercise. Does that mean it's bad? No. Because there's a big difference between an acute bout of inflammation and chronic inflammation. And even inflammation is quite a, what's the word I'm looking for? Not a loose term. It's not what I mean, but like it covers a lot of ground. Netflix is generally not somewhere I'd ever get nutrition information from. And the fact that you've asked the question means you probably are just intrigued and want to find out more. And I absolutely don't blame you at all. But yeah, I'm very wary of anyone who says, I would just, this is general advice. If someone says a food is inflammatory, I would hold up a red flag a little bit. Now, there are like dietary patterns potentially that are anti-inflammatory, like Mediterranean style dietary patterns, for example. But it's never like, oh, if you eat this food, this is what happens. You'll know, like as in blueberries. Remember when they were like superfood? I don't think that's a thing anymore. But like they're so anti-inflammatory. And it's like, who sat there eating 8 bowls of blueberries, solely blueberries a day, and then measuring what happens on a whole body level? No one. Blueberries would probably be included as an overall Mediterranean style dietary pattern, which by the way does include dairy and some meat, but it's predominantly plant-based foods. So just be mindful of anyone who says like this specific food is bad or this specific food is good, and they try and over-science it with like mechanisms. That's usually ignore.
I've actually just Googled this to see which one it is. And I remember this is pre-lockdown. It was 2018, 2019 when it came out. And as you were speaking, I was like, that is exactly what they said. I remember this bit where what they did, and it's horrible because they really use scare tactics. They basically took a load of men and they fed them a really fatty meal that was like a cheeseburger, like really high in like saturated fats. And then they hooked them up to some kind of device and they measured their normal, like involuntary nighttime erections, like while they were asleep. And then they did it with like a plant-based meal. And then they basically said, oh, you have fewer erections after you've had this high-fat meal. Eating meat, therefore, messes with your libido and your sexuality, and basically your manhood is at risk if you're eating it. And I remember it was when I was working in Pure Gym. I remember like a few of the PTs like asking me, because they're like, oh, you're doing your master's in nutrition, like what truth is there in this? And I was like, none whatsoever. Like, what is this? And I actually went and watched it and just sat there like, I need to take notes and go back to work tomorrow and have a conversation, because they were really worried about like, oh my God, I could actually be damaging my penis and my ability to have children because I'm eating a burger once a week. And I was just like, that has got to be the meanest tactic. No,
I remember though, it was, I would say my social media is very balanced in terms of like who I follow, and but it was more males. I remember like sharing about Game Changer and moving to plant-based, and now I know why.
Wow.
Yeah. Mean.
Wow. And it explains why my sex drive is fantastic, honestly. Oh my God. Okay, Anna.
Any low calorie, high protein vegetarian meal ideas, please, preferably dairy free due to dietary issues.
Low calorie, high protein, vegetarian or vegan.
Veggie.
But dairy free potentially, so I guess.
Yeah.
My favorites are just putting whatever pulses and beans and veggies I have into the slow cooker with some tinned tomatoes and some oregano and seeing what comes out. Like, honestly, that is, I don't really follow, like, again, if I follow a recipe, it's a Lucy Lord recipe, right? Obviously, but I don't often follow recipes. They are that you're never going to get a super low calorie vegetarian option. You're rarely going to get that's dairy free. Rarely. Potential, there are some of the corn sausages, not all of them are okay in terms of macros for low calorie. I mean, Linda McCartney sausages to some degree. But ultimately, most vegetarian protein sources do have additional carbs or fat in them. And if you're looking for something like a chicken breast, it doesn't really exist. There is a corn fillet. Do you know the corn fillets that are like frozen?
No.
Sometimes I add them to like sometimes I'll add them to like stews or stir fries or something. They are generally higher in protein and lower in carb than some of the other corn sources. They get very tiresome very fast.
And you have to eat quite a large portion. It's not like you can have 100 grams the way that you would with chicken. It's a lot of food, and it's high fiber as well, so it's very, very filling. So to actually get enough protein, and that can be tough.
Yeah.
One of my clients introduced me, and now I'm obsessed with this account on Instagram called No Meat Disco. And they're not all low calorie. I mean, he doesn't really talk about calories. It's really like their vibe is, I'm a vegan. Where'd you get your protein? I'll show you where I get my protein. But they're genuinely high protein recipes, and they're really delicious. I'm obsessed with it. My favorite one, what is called, I've got it here. Turkish beans with couscous, and it's 34 grams of protein, and it's delicious. It's butter beans in like a harissa sauce, and it's got like fresh parsley and mint, and then you make it with some whole grain couscous, and then you use the Alpro yogurt, which is my favorite one anyway, which is dairy free, high protein, and you put like lemon zest and lemon juice into it, and you mix it up. And it sounds complicated, but it takes like 10 minutes to make. And it's so good that I would serve that to any of my friends that aren't vegans, and I know that they would enjoy it. Like, they would just be like, this is really delicious. So I would highly recommend No Meat Disco on Instagram for like inspiration, because since my client introduced me to it, like every now and again, I'm like, oh my God, have you tried this one yet? Like, and we are recipe swapping regularly. So yeah, highly recommend.
I'm gonna get on that. That sounds pretty delicious. I'm gonna
Delicious.
do that after this. Are those like Aldi protein pots dairy free?
The protein puddings.
Yeah.
No, they do have dairy in them. But interestingly, so I was talking to Roz about this a while ago, because as I was saying, like earlier on, I did elimination diet, realized that dairy was an issue for me, eliminated it for a very, very long time, and then kind of reached a point where I was like, I wonder if it's okay. And I started to introduce like very, very small amounts. And I've kind of got a tolerance level now where I know I can get away with so much, whereas in the past I couldn't have any at all. And I was speaking to Roz about this. I was like, can intolerances come and go? Because I wasn't born with this intolerance. I was fine for a long, long time. And she had kind of, she'll talk you through it in way more depth than I can, but she'd said basically it can. And at times of extreme stress, or if there's other things going on, like physiologically, it might get worse, which makes sense because when it started, there's a lot going on. But as my stress levels have reduced and I've got better stress management and my life has changed considerably, I'm able to tolerate, a certain amount without any symptoms. But those Lidl and Aldi protein pots, another reason why highly processed food is great is they're so highly processed, that they are, it's, yeah, they're very gentle dairy options. So if you're kind of like a bit intolerant, I would recommend trying something like that, because if I go for something like Greek yogurt or ice cream, it's an instant no. But those ones are all good.
Interesting. I do know that like you can develop intolerances over time for sure. I am, you might be able to see my eye at the moment. I look like Darth, not Darth Vader, but I was saying to Anna before the podcast, I look like a snake. Like I feel like I look like a snake from a cartoon. For people who can't see my eye, it's like really bloodshot. I've got burst blood vessels in my eye. And I think it came from a combination of things, but at the weekend I ordered like Thai food. I was treating myself. I just had like a couple of hours on the phone. I had a couple of hours on the phone to my Californian family, and I was going to get like Thai food, and it's going to be like a really nice evening. And it was something that I've had before. And I was speaking to my sister-in-law on the phone, and I was starting to get like an itchy neck. And I was like, "Oh, that's weird." And then I was going up my face, and she was like, "I was like, can you see this on my face?" And she said, "You're just got looking a bit flush." And I said, "Yeah, it's a bit itchy." And then I came off the phone because my face was getting really hot, and I just had come out in like this rash from my neck all the way up to my face. My eye was bloodshot, my lips were swollen, like my eyes were swollen. Took an antihistamine, went for a walk, and it cooled down by the next day. But then I had an emotional breakdown, and then my eye just decided to do this. Regardless, obviously, I assume it was something in the meal that I ate because it was a different thing, and I just developed this. Probably because of pregnancy, there's some sort of intolerance there that I didn't know that I had. Like, for God's sake, bodies are wild. But this is also like such a good point of like why you don't just want to be like, oh, I can't have that. Unless you're like celiac or something, of course. And of course there are intolerances that might not go away, but it's a good reminder to be curious about these things. No idea. Georgia, I think let's go with you.
We'll go again. Okay. This is one of Roz's clients. She or they ask, "I'm struggling with clothes a lot at the moment, finding it hard to choose what to wear, not liking how anything looks on my body, not liking the clothes I have, but not wanting to buy new ones either, as all the clothes and styles I like look better on smaller bodies." Might be something other people struggle with too. For sure.
I think my, really important fashion advice here is what I find helpful, do you, is dressing not for like what looks good on other people, but what feels good on me. And like my best friend can wear some stuff, and I'm like, oh my God, if I wore that, like I'd look like I was trying to dress like a teenager. Like it would just look obscene on me. Example, high tops on me. It's never going to happen. My ex was like, "I love high tops on a girl," and I was like, "It's never going to happen." He's like, "Why? I look good." I'm like, "I promise you, if I wear high tops, I look obscene. I look like some sort of like zebra with like big trainers on. Like it just, there's just, it's not a good look for me." And I love it on other people. And I look at influencers, and I'm like, "Oh, that, I love that. I love that attire." But I know if I was wearing something like that, especially right now, like I would just feel really, really uncomfortable. I look at pregnant bodies who wear like, they really emphasize their bump, and they're really like, if I wear a non-maternity t-shirt at the moment, I'm like, oh my God, I can't actually breathe. Like I feel hideous. I would love to be comfortable in those clothes, but I'm not. And I think for me personally, at least, just owning, okay, that doesn't work for me. I know what does work for me, and it's usually like baggy boho, whatever, or like just maternity stuff. That's absolutely fine. So I make the most of that, and you can make the most of it. The reason why I think the times it's frustrating is when I don't make the most of it, and I refuse to buy new clothes that feel comfortable for me, and I just think I can't wear that stuff because that doesn't feel good for me. So I'm not going to buy new stuff. I'll just wear my old stuff, and then you do feel crap because either your old stuff is also uncomfortable, or if you're anything like me, your black is now grey and your white is now orange, and that's why you feel gross. So I think the problem is less, probably less so, like not suiting stuff, and more so that you're maybe not allowing yourself to buy stuff that does feel good for you.
Yeah, me and Amelia had a conversation at the weekend where I told her everything I was wearing. I look like trash, which in hindsight is not the kindest thing I could have said to myself, but it was very much in relation to me wearing things that, I mean, this is why I like things like I can't even remember what it was
Shop
called.
style. Shop style? No.
Stitch Fix.
Yeah, but it's not called that anymore. They've changed name. But it's now called Outfittery for people that, but I generally don't, like, I don't buy a lot of stuff. So all of the stuff that I was wearing for an occasion coming up was from like years ago. And I mean, my body is not massively different, but it is different. And I think regardless, like, as you get older, your style naturally changes as well. So I think, like you were saying, Amelia, like, maybe you are, well, looking at styles that might be suited to a different body type, and what you want to be looking at is, well, here's my body in the today, and what might make me feel good in that. And that's where, like, even if you don't buy things from these sorts of websites, even if they just give you an idea of different looks to go for, that you can kind of go out shopping with a few new ideas might be helpful.
I think as well, like if you're not choosing to be comfortable, then you're choosing to be uncomfortable. And when we're thinking about self-compassion, which is like, a core pillar of what we work on with clients, you wouldn't expect that of a friend or someone that you love. You wouldn't be like, yeah, you should just be uncomfortable because, you'd be like, no, please wear things that are really comfy. And I think one of the best things for me, when I'm going shopping is I take either my sister or I take my boyfriend, because I'll walk into a clothes shop and be like, there's nothing here, nothing for me, storm out and be like, I hate shopping. And they'll be like, turn around, and they'll have like 10 things in their hands, like, you should try these things on. And I'll look at it and think, no, but I'll put it on to shut you up. And 9 times out of 10, I'm like, oh, that's actually quite a nice color. Oh, that's a really good cut. I would never put those two things together. And honestly, every time, like they're just like, little smug smile, like, I know they should genuinely, that should be their job. They should work in shops and just help people find stuff that looks really good on them. But again, like I would never pick those things, and I would never think those are kind of clothes for me. And it's not outrageous stuff, it's just not what I would typically think is my style. So sometimes it's nice to get a different perspective if you're very stuck on, like, clearly like me, it's like there's nothing here for me. When someone else is like, there is a lot here, that can be quite nice, and it can make it more fun as well, I think.
Fun fact, I used to work in Topshop and do that exact thing for people. I used to have
You.
style, everyone, back in the day, and I was actually very good at my job.
You're a personal shopper.
No, I wasn't, but I worked there for like 4 or 5 years, so I did a lot of the windows and the styling of the stores, and dressed myself like I was from a Topshop magazine. And it didn't matter. This was the thing too, like that was in the days of like Kate Moss was my idol, when Kate Moss had the Topshop line, right? So obviously I got everything from that, spent all of my food money on Kate Moss clothes, and then just had to eat pasta for ages because I shouldn't. But yeah, I loved it. But and I would be like, try and be as small as I could, because that was when I was in my unhealthy restriction phase of life. And then I was like, well, if I can get as skinny as Kate Moss, then I'll just dress it, any of these clothes will look good on me, because I had that mentality, complete disordered, unhelpful mentality. And I thought I looked like the bee's knees, and I see pictures of myself and I'm like, wow, that's a good time of your life. Good, it's probably not the right time. So yeah, just come to me for your fashion advice. I've done it all. I'm still that person, deep inside. Okay, thank you all for your questions. Thank you both so much.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.